Jones, and tonight for From the Frontline, we'll be discussing how the French and Bolshevik revolutions continue to impact us today. In the studio we have with us Dr. Hammond. Good evening.
Good evening.
So, we have some very interesting anniversaries coming up, not necessarily positive ones, but anniversaries nonetheless. Firstly, on the 14th of July, we have Bastille Day, which is celebrated in France, which was the launch of the French Revolution. And on the 17th of July, that marks the 100th anniversary of the murder of the Tsar's family during the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And then on the 18th of July, we have Mandela Day, 100th birthday, I believe, if he was still alive.
Yes, not that I think he's celebrating at this stage, but it's true. And all of these are very significant because the United Nations has attempted to mark Mandela Day, the 18th of July, which is Mandela's birthday. Mm-hmm. For years, they've been pushing it as an international holiday, which is unprecedented. I don't know that there's anyone else's birthday that the UN's trying to, or anyone's trying to make an international holiday.
Sure.
And I mean, it's just bizarre because it's like an attempt to launch a new religion. Mm-hmm. And you have people even now in South Africa saying, what are you going to be doing for Mandela Day? And, well, what I do for every Mandela Day, I'll be sending out Bible studies on how idolatry is the most condemned sin in the Bible and mm-hmm. how serious it is not to give in to this humanist religion, which is attempting to put a man, a secular humanist, Marxist, socialist man, in the place mm-hmm. of our Lord Jesus Christ. We should be worshipping God alone. And like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we should be the kind of people who say, when they say you must bow before this idol, or you'll be thrown into the fiery furnace. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego responded, our God whom we serve is able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we still won't bow before your idols, nor will we serve your gods.
Yeah, that's truly incredible and an inspiration. Now, why is it important for us to learn from history? What do these dates mean to us, and why does it matter in order to learn these before we get back to the main topic?
Well, yes. I mean, just the amount of people who say things like, well, I'm not interested in history, and none of my people are interested in history. And then you can say, well, that's why your country's in such a mess. Because if we knew history, we would be able to avoid a lot of the problems. Forewarned is forearmed. So when people come up with, why should I care about dates and dead people, and what possible relevance could all these long ago events have for me today? Well, just take, for example, 9/11. Did those responsible just choose an arbitrary date for the aircraft hijackings and terror attacks on 11th of September 2001? There's a strategic importance to September 11th that would be significant for Islamic jihadists. On 11th of September 1565, the Ottoman-Turkish siege of Malta was decisively defeated. On the 11th of November in 1683, the siege of Vienna, the high watermark of the Ottoman-Turkish Empire, was lifted and defeated decisively by the Battle of Vienna, where the Polish cavalry came in, and in fact, that's where we get croissants from, because the Viennese bakers decided to make a crescent-shaped pastry to celebrate the fact that it had the Turks for breakfast. And it was Viennese-born Queen Marie Antoinette who introduced the croissant to France, hence the French term croissant of crescent in 1770. And in fact, the first bagel was a gift to King Jan Sobieski of Poland to commemorate the king's victorious cavalry charge that broke the Turkish lines. Or another anecdote is the Turkish army had lots of bags of coffee in the abandoned camp. And so after the Battle of Vienna, 11th of September, 1683, an enterprising Capuchin friar invented cappuccinos. As a result of, he opened the first coffee house in Vienna as a result of this. I mean, okay, that's from the interesting to the trivial. But take the assassination of Sarajevo, the shot that sparked the First World War, the greatest catastrophe in Western civilization. 28th of June, 1914. It was the date that the heir to the throne of Austria, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his beloved wife Sophie were assassinated in Sarajevo. Now, first of all, it was their 14th wedding anniversary, tragically, for Franz and Sophie. And also, on that same day, 28th June, his security services should have noticed that this was the most significant date for nationalists in Serbia, because it was on that date, the 28th of June, 1389, a long time ago, but the Battle of Kosovo was the most disastrous defeat of the Serbs at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. And they always marked this anniversary, which was highly symbolic. It was a major rallying point for Serb nationalists. And so when people question whether dates and dead people in history have any relevance for us today, they need to remember history illustrates the consequence of ideas and actions. So everything has consequences. Mm-hmm. And if we study history, we will see examples and illustrations of man's depravity and rebellion against God, and also God's mercy and grace and sovereignty and intervening in the cause of human events. So it's so important that we learn from history. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, if we do not know our own history, we'll simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again.
Sure. Yeah, that is tragic. We definitely need to learn from our past and our history in order to be alert, and so that we can try and not make the same mistakes in the future.
It's true. The longer you look back, the further you can look forward. And a tall building needs to lay deep foundations, and a tall tree needs a deep root structure. So forewarned is forearmed. If we can just understand the times, we'll know what God's people ought to do.
For sure. Yeah. Okay, awesome. So then, the first anniversary that we have coming up is the 14th of July, which, as we said, is Bastille Day. And that commemorates the storming of the Bastille, which then launched the French Revolution. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the Bastille was a fortress. But what relevance does that have? Why did they storm that Bastille? How did that...
Well, the Bastille was more symbolic. It wasn't even that important. The Bastille was, in many cases, a symbol. It was a fortress that was a Middle Ages type fortress. And so what it became was a symbol of hated tyranny. And there's a lot of legend that grew out of it. And so basically, they celebrated the fact that they stormed the old fortress of the Bastille and then they dismantled it. But part of the whole, legend of it was that the Bastille is meant to have housed all these political prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it happens, there was not a single political prisoner there. There were mere 7 criminals in this massive Bastille. And while the French Revolution's officially date from this event, the 14th of July, 1789, the Bastille was actually completely irrelevant. But, you know, who wants facts to get in the way of a good story? And this very noble storming of the Bastille isn't quite as noble when you get to know it either, because the lieutenant governor of the Bastille, Monsieur de Launay, was guaranteed safe conduct if he surrendered the fortress under white flag of truce, which they did. And immediately they violated the solemn promises of safe conduct and so on. They massacred the soldiers and the governor, chopped off the heads, carried them around spikes throughout the streets, which you don't tend to see depicted in the average noble storming of the Bastille film they've got these days. And then they found a mere 7 criminals in the Bastille. But nevertheless, they dressed this up as some noble, wonderful, tremendous, the people rising up. And it's just extraordinary how something so vile could have become a symbol of national pride. The fact that if the average Frenchman knew what they were celebrating on the 14th of July and the consequences of it, they surely wouldn't want to celebrate. They might mourn, but not celebrate.
Sure, that's so interesting. And the French Revolution has definitely been one of the more influential events in modern history, and possibly even a prototype revolution and inspiration and even a model of all the like socialist and communist revolutions that we've heard of subsequently.
It is the gold standard. It's the model. It's the prototype for all revolutions. That's so true. And there's a lot of myth and romantic legend about what politicians would like the French Revolution to have been, but the reality was the French Revolution was an anti-Christian monstrous horror. The name Liberty, Equality, Fraternity is not the whole story. It was Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, or Morte. Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, or Death. That's the full motto. And 40,000 people lost their heads to the guillotine, what they call Madame Guillotine, or kissing the basket, or sneezing into the basket. And they had all kinds of stupid, callous jokes around the guillotine. And then they killed another 300,000 people publicly through either executions, firing squads, drownings, and other methods of mass murder. Ultimately, millions died in the 25 years of revolutionary war and upheavals that resulted, that churned the whole of Europe. It went as far as Moscow, causing chaos. So the French Revolution, it's extraordinary how it's commemorated as something wonderful. And I remember even South Africa in 1989. I mean, why on earth would they do this? But they brought out postage stamps in South Africa celebrating the French Revolution. And I at the time wrote letters to editor of newspapers, you know, speaking about the French Revolution and what is there to celebrate. Mm-hmm. And we had people at that time wanting to do a revolution in South Africa. Now, at this moment, we could be entering the second phase of the revolution in South Africa.
Mm.
And to think that our country was foolishly celebrating something as vile as the French Revolution, it's bizarre. Lord Acton, in his lectures on the French Revolution, said, the appalling thing about the French Revolution is not the tumult, but the design.
Mm.
Through all the fire and smoke, we perceive the evidence of calculating organization. The managers remain studiously concealed and masked, but there's no doubt about their presence from the first.
Mm-hmm.
So the French Revolution was not this popular movement from the ground. It was a well-organized from the top down.
Mm.
And the people who suffered the most were the poor people, of course. They were the cannon fodder for the revolution.
Mm. And as you say, that it's absurd that South Africa might have glorified this day or whatever. Meanwhile, what they actually was doing is, as you say, organizing and preparing. So it probably wasn't coincidence at all.
Yes, at the very best it was stupidity, but more likely it was disinformation and preparing people for the idea that a revolution's good and wonderful. And often you get this idea that, oh, you know, how wonderful this was. Well, I, having studied a lot of revolutions and having been a missionary to Persky Church for over 36 years, having ministered in countries as far afield as Poland, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Albania, I've seen communist countries under communism, under the dictatorship, behind the Iron Curtain, during the Cold War. I've ministered in Mozambique and Angola immediately after the revolutions and seen what goes on throughout Africa where there's revolutions. And I defy anybody to point to a revolution, a Marxist-Leninist revolution, that has made the situation better for anyone. In every case, the liberators became worse oppressors, worse tyrants than what they presumed to overthrow. And so, you know, to suggest that Louis XVI was a horrible oppressive person is ludicrous. He was a reformer. Louis XVI is the one who called back after something like 80 years that the Estates General had been closed, and he opened up the Estates General. He did so many things. He, in fact, signed an edict for toleration of religion, which Louis XIV had abolished. He brought back religious toleration for Protestants or any form of faith. So he was a reforming king, and Marie Antoinette was a very gracious, kind person who cared for the poor, who was running soup kitchens and giving a lot of her personal wealth out to the poor. And the way how the media has trashed her and tried to make her out to be some callous individual who would say, if they don't have any bread, why don't they eat cake? Which all in people who've looked into these revolutions and histories don't believe is credible, because she was Austrian, and therefore the revolutionaries hate her. She is extremely intelligent. She's definitely more intelligent than the king, and that's why they wanted to target her and isolate her and get rid of her, because they were afraid of her. And the revolutionaries really put out disinformation to try and make people despise her, because the common people actually loved Marie Antoinette. She was very attractive, she was very eloquent, she was very articulate, she was very compassionate and charitable, and they trashed her with this. So that today, most people, all they know about Marie Antoinette is, oh, isn't she the one who said, they don't have any bread, let them eat cake? But it's fake. Like so many things that are there in history. But once we get to understand, oh, but that's what revolutions do. They lie, and they're based on disinformation and propaganda.
For sure. So what is it exactly that the people were revolting against? What caused the revolution?
Well, if you believe the propaganda, that the people were reacting against the repression of Louis XVI, but in fact it's the opposite. He was a reformer, and what they were doing was they were hijacking a time of reform in order to promote revolution, because the reform was a threat to the revolutionary's aims. And in fact, you could say the same thing about the Bolshevik Revolution, where Tsar Nicholas was not a harsh man. Here's the man who'd given more power to the Duma, the parliament of Russia, than any of his predecessors. And It's interesting how they will often damn someone who's a reformer as repressive to justify their revolution. But what really is behind the French Revolution, first and foremost, was economic chaos. And the economic problems started with France getting involved in the Seven Years' War against Britain and Germany, which they lost. And that cost them a fortune. So then the next thing was they supported America's War of Independence against Britain as a kind of vindictive reaction. Well, you caused us to lose Canada, and so we're going to help you lose the American colonies. And so it was a tit-for-tat kind of violence. But the ruinous Seven Years' War and then the American War of Independence, which created vast debt for France, added to the financial crisis, which propelled the French state into bankruptcy, that led them to want to call the Estates General back in order to raise new taxes, and this provided an opportunity for the revolutionaries.
Sure, that is so fascinating. And then at the end of the day, the leaders of the revolution will promote this utopia, but the only ones to benefit ever are those leaders, and the people at the bottom just get more poor. Isn't that so?
Very much so. And of course, there's a clear case of people behind the scenes who were orchestrating this. And the best book I've read on this is by Otto Scott. Otto Scott has written Robespierre: Inside the French Revolution. And he writes some fascinating insights. And he points out how the French intellectuals, the middle and upper classes, had grown ashamed of their country, their history and their institutions, as a result of their news media, which was a very new thing. Such a phenomenon had never before arisen in any nation or race throughout the history of mankind. There was a great loosening. The country was coming apart. Since the decadent days of Rome, for the first time, pornography emerged from the caves and circulated openly in a civilized society. And the Catholic Church in France was intellectually gutted. The priests had lost their faith. The congregations had lost their faith. Strange cults were appearing. Sex rituals, black magic, Satanism. Perversion became not only acceptable, but fashionable. Homosexuals held public office, and they held public balls, dances to which heterosexuals were invited, and the police guarded their carriages. And the air grew thick with plans to restructure and reconstruct all traditional French society and institutions, including marriage, property, church, everything. Sure. And so this was, in fact, because of revolutionary writers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who popularized the whole idea of the noble savage, that the more civilized you are, the more evil you are. But the more savage you are, the better you are. That people who run around naked and eat the neighbors and have multiple wives are more noble than people who are hypocrites because they've got one man, one wife, and children, and they go to church. And they're basically, the media and the arts and the plays had started to denigrate people. And so Jean-Jacques Rousseau and then Voltaire, with his very virulent writing, had brought the people to a position where they thought that it was more attractive and interesting to support revolution, to destroy everything, because they didn't think anything, not their families, not their church, not their state, deserved to be protected and preserved. So there was a brainwashing, an indoctrination, a subverting, a seducing. There was also very much a corruption of the arts and the media. And behind it, you can see the hands of the bankers who were actually benefiting from a lot of the disaster that happened economically in the countries. The bankers walked away with fortunes. And of course, they had a lot of the gold and silver and other real valuables of many of the great houses stored. And when the heads of all those homes and all the great people of France end up in a guillotine, well, who managed to keep all the wealth of those people? Well, the bankers, of course. So they benefited tremendously. And you could see that there was a real, I said the journals were mixtures of politics and smut. The agitators extravagantly discussed the church, and they never discussed the church without mention of scandal. And they never discussed the government without criticism. And they were always giving credit to revolutionaries. So it started with a moral crisis, went on with a debt crisis, and before you knew it, they were able to get the people to a point where everyone wanted change, although they didn't realize that the change was going to be a disastrous change.
Yeah, change isn't always necessarily a good thing. And lies definitely seem to be the foundation of a revolution, from beginning to end, as they feed them disinformation in the beginning, continue to bombard them with propaganda, and then even when all these lies don't get fulfilled and the people get rightly outraged, they then just continue to feed them more disinformation or give them a scapegoat or distract them. Or
definitely scapegoats, definitely distraction. And that's why you saw the revolution go through the two phases. The first phase, getting political control, and the second phase, getting control of everything from schools, farms, land reform, expropriation of compensation, all the way through to even taking over the churches, even making the ministers in the church to be servants of the state. And everything was coordinated chaos and fanaticism. But once the people had put all their faith in the revolutionaries, and the revolutionaries had taken all power, then they needed wars with all the countries around to distract the people from the fact that they were a domestic failure. They couldn't produce what they promised, so they had to keep distracting people with new wars. Hence the 25 years of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, it's doomed to fail from the beginning, and the only people to benefit, as we say, are the leaders. And just like in Zim and now even in South Africa, the few who are benefiting don't care if the economy collapses, as they have made their millions, and even though the country is ending up in ruins, it's no difference to them, as they have benefited, the only ones that have benefited.
Yes, and it's not just incompetence and failure. It was more than that. They had a series of events combined to create food shortages and hunger. The agitators would pan out across the countryside to destroy all the grain stores, to terrorize the inhabitants, to hire mobs to stage spontaneous riots and protests. I mean, it was not spontaneity, it was actually organized. And they did it so that everything fell apart with astonishing coordination. And they managed to actually reach the stage where the people were starving in the cities. And that was what they wanted. They wanted to bring it all down. And most people can't understand, why would any government want to undermine its own foundation? I mean, the agriculture is its foundation. No, but it was part of it, because if you can't get people hungry, then they might be thinking and evaluating and working out counter-revolution. But the revolutionaries always want to get people to a point where they're hungry, scared, and quiet.
And as you say, agriculture is the foundation of the economy, so why would they want to destroy that? Yet what is going on in South Africa currently with the farmers, the agriculture being undermined and destroyed? And even so, we can see that whereas before we were exporting food throughout Southern Africa, we are now having to import food in South Africa for the first time in history. So
it is bizarre. And so you've got all these people lining up to give response saying, but economically it doesn't make sense. Look at the advantage of allowing these incredibly hardworking farmers to continue to provide for the nation, and how essential it is and the disastrous consequence of avoiding it. But what these people speaking logical, coherent economic sense of forgetting is, you talk with revolutionaries, they don't think in the same terms we think. They think in terms of constructive chaos. Vladimir Lenin said, never underestimate the value of constructive chaos. And so the whole goal is to create chaos, because only out of the chaos will they be able to seize control and wrest control from the hands of those that traditionally have had any kind of stability, which is the producers, the farmers, the hardworking people. And so a revolutionary needs chaos. He needs people to be hungry, he needs people to be scared, and he wants people to be quiet. And of course, scapegoats, distraction, that's the name of the game.
Yeah, and they definitely have to distract the population, which is, as we can see, this is always a pattern, and whether it is through man-made famine or starvation or just general murders and killing of the people. I know another one is often deportation, where in transit they often get physically exhausted or and die out through that and leave the country. But in South Africa, the people are doing it voluntary. They are voting with their feet, and so many competent people are leaving South Africa due to not being able to get work, due to crime, due to whatever it may be, and they are leaving themselves in their own accord, which is tragic.
Yes. Otto Scott, in his book Robespierre, says, Paris, like the nation, was divided into the politically active and the passive, between the many confused, disorganized, and abstracted, and the highly concentrated, organized, and intent few. And so it was in the French Revolution that the terms left-wing and right-wing were first coined. And many people would find it interesting to know where this term left and right came from. The left and the right, as documented by James Billington, Fire in the Hearts of Men, Origin of Revolutionary Faith, he says that the left wing deliberately called themselves left wing because in the Bible, the Lord always refers to the saved as his sheep on the right. Those on his right, he'll say, well done, good and faithful servant, enter joy of our Lord. When he deals with the left, he speaks to those on his left, to the goats, to the damned, to the those of the devil, the weeds, and so on. He says, depart from me, cursed, in the lake of fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And so the revolutionaries in France deliberately designate themselves, we are the left wing, we are the goats, we are the damned, we are Antichrist, we are against God, we are against Christianity. And so interesting that today you might have a person call themselves a left-wing Christian, because it just means they don't really understand the origin of the concept. Mm-hmm. Because even the Bible says a fool's heart is on his left hand. Sure. And how we are to be those who are on God's right. We are to be on the right side of God as opposed to being on the wrong side of God. Mm-hmm. And so the term left and right, today many people may have different views on it, but the point is, in the French Revolution, left wing meant we're against God, we're against Christ.
Sure, yeah. And that's so fascinating, just thinking of how earlier you were talking about the UN wanting to try and make a public holiday out of Mandela's birthday. And it was incredible because during the French Revolution, they invented a new religion, which they called the Cult of Reason. And they enthroned an actress to be the goddess of the French people, where they turned the churches into what they named temples of reason and so on. So that's very interesting that you said earlier about them wanting to make Mandela Day a public holiday.
Yes, indeed. It's extraordinary that at the beginning you get the impression the revolutionaries are against religion. And after a while you realize, no, they're only against competing religions. They're trying to establish a new religion. Mm-hmm. And that's what Karl Marx said, that all the old gods will need to be deposed and new gods will have to be established. And you can see it how, for example, of the Bolshevik Revolution, they put the grave of the tomb of Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, right outside the walls of the Kremlin, which is the seat of government in Russia, and on Red Square, they'd have the people lining up to come and worship in this Egyptian pyramid-styled mausoleum or tomb, and they would have the May Day parades on the 1st of May, with all the Politburo of the Soviet Union standing on top of the, literally above the bones of Lenin. And the symbolism, they're deeply symbolic. It's very religious. Mm-hmm. How they'd all come past saluting towards the Politburo standing on tops of the corpse of Lenin. And what a bizarre kind of man-made religion. But they developed their own everything. Mm-hmm. They've got their own hierarchy. They've got their own scriptures, Marxist manifesto and so on. Mm-hmm. They have their own authority structure, like the Catholic Church might have had the Pope and the Cardinals. Well, they've got the Politburo and the of the Soviet Union. They've got, like the Catholic Church may have their priests. Well, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution had their commissars. And they had their own sacrifices, like we might go and remember the blood sacrifice of Christ in Lord's Supper. Well, they would have blood sacrifice, literally, where they would be killing the enemies of the revolution, which is also blood sacrifices. And on, you can just see there's a religion. In Romania, that 8,000 hymns composed for the praise of the state and the Communist Party and Ceausescu, the dictator.
Sure.
In Soviet Union, Stalin, they had the League of Militant Godless. They closed down churches and turned them into houses of atheism, where they would want people, scientific atheism, they called it. And they literally tried to start a new religion. I mean, they failed, but they sure tried hard. Mm.
Sure, that's incredible. As we can see that it's always against Christianity, these revolutions. And Stalin, who killed over 40 million people, he was trying to liquidate the entire Christian church, as you are just mentioning now. And also Mao Zedong, who tried to eradicate and destroy Christianity. So it's very interesting how it's always against Christianity. It's never against yes. Hinduism or Buddhism. And I was chatting the other day, which was to a friend, who was quite interesting, and we're saying how you don't either see debates between atheists and Hindus or whatever. It's always between Christian and atheism or Christian and Islam, or it's never between other religions. It's always against Christianity. It's very interesting.
Well, same with blasphemy. You know, if you want to blaspheme the name of Jesus Christ, no problem. In fact, they're pushing it in Hollywood. They're pushing it all over the place, even in many schools and colleges. To blaspheme Christ, perfectly acceptable. In fact, the only way you can mention the name of Jesus on an average university campus is as a blasphemy. That's constitutionally protected. But if you try and defend Jesus Christ and point out that he is the greatest person ever lived, or the greatest teacher, or that everything good in this world, as documented by What If Jesus Had Never Been Born by James Kennedy and Jerry Newcomb, or by book by Professor Alvin Schmidt, How Christianity Transforms Civilization, and show that Christianity has brought everything good in this world. Everything good in this world comes from the teachings of Christ, the example of Christ, and the people following the teachings of Christ. And that sort of thing would be anathema, blasphemy to the New World Order, not allowed in the colleges. But now, if you want to criticize, for example, Muhammad, many universities would prevent you from doing it. You can't blaspheme Muhammad. If you wanted to say something against Buddha or Lao Tzu or Confucius, many would, you're being culturally insensitive, and they'd probably shut you down for hate speech. If you want to say something against Nelson Mandela, Mao Zedong, Vladimir Lenin, Karl Marx, you'd be in deep trouble. I mean, that's serious blasphemy now. Mm-hmm. But blaspheme Jesus Christ? No problem. That's the one person that you can blaspheme is Jesus Christ. So you can see that while the revolutionaries often claim to be atheistic, they actually don't feel that strongly about the other religions, what we would call false religions, because of that very reason. They're false, they're not a real threat. But they feel deeply threatened by real Christianity, Bible-based Christianity, and genuine Jesus Christ ministry. So that, if you dare bring up anything that blasphemes the new religion of secular humanism, they will shut you down, accuse you of hate speech, give you naught for your assignment, kick you out, not appoint you, and so on. They've got their different ways of dealing with you. They don't burn you at the stake generally these days, but they do destroy your career and your prospects for promotion. And so there's different ways. The Inquisition today is real, and they're enforcing a new belief in a state religion. They're just doing it in a different manner from the Middle Ages Inquisition.
For sure, yeah. We get told to be politically correct, and if we speak out even against things such as abortion or euthanasia, which is clearly forbidden in the Bible, we then get told we're being politically incorrect or, as you say, insensitive. And what's so tragic is that even Christians are starting to fall for this nonsense of the need to be politically correct and sensitive. And furthermore, society promotes equality, and that is subconsciously to fear and reject difference. Meanwhile, at the end of the day, we are different, and the Lord has made us all unique. But with this fear of difference, the people are impressionable and therefore controllable. So it's very fascinating.
It really is. And in fact, the 20th century has proved to be the worst century of persecution in history. The 20th century has proved to be the greatest killer of all time, 20th century secular humanist state, the revolutionary states, the communist, Marxist, Leninist, socialist states. More Christians have been martyred for their faith in the 20th century than all other 19 centuries combined. Sure. And it's come in the name of social Darwinism, survival of the fittest. And they've devalued life, because if you just, from molecules to mud to monkeys to man, just evolved slime, you're just a cosmic accident, matter in motion, then as Oliver Wendell Holmes says, I see no reason for attributing to man a significant difference in kind from that which belongs to a grain of sand.
Sure, yeah. So if you believe that your father is the king, you are going to act like a prince. But if you believe that you come from apes, you're going to act like an animal. And that's so evident all around us today.
They act worse than animals.
Yeah. And as you said, Holmes said that we have the same value as a grain of sand, but that is so blatantly unbiblical, as we have a soul, we have morals, we have emotion, and we're made in the image of God. And so Jesus even thought we were worth dying for while we were still sinners.
Yes.
And yet, as you say, they just completely devalue life.
In fact, it was those who first waged a war against God, the God is dead movement, that they created a great vacuum. And the huge vacuum, the 20th century has been filled with how that vacuum has been filled with the totalitarian state, the loss of freedom for millions, the concentration camps, the Gulag archipelago, the rise of abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, suicide, crime out of all proportions, the most savage wars in the history of the world. The 20th century has actually been the worst century in the history of mankind. And how do the evolutionists explain it? Well, they ignore it. They say there's the best of times, and in fact it's been the worst of times. And we've seen the rise of gangster statesmen along with secular humanism, atheism, evolutionism, situation ethics. It's brought about these gangster statesmen like Vladimir Lenin, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, Pol Pot, Robert Mugabe, and many more wannabes like them. Julius Malema just comes to mind as somebody who would love to be a Marxist mass murdering dictator, and he's trying hard.
Who conveniently celebrated the Bolshevik Revolution last year, calling it the October Revolution?
The Great October Revolution. So the EFF, that's the Everything for Free Party, or the Economic Freedom Party, Francis, they literally celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in rallies yesterday, last year. So just imagine, we got people who worship what the Bolshevik Revolution, what Vladimir Lenin stood for, and there's a large percentage of South Africans who are voting for these people.
Sure, tragic. So Dr. Hammond, tell us more about the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, the Bolshevik Revolution, of course, was one of the greatest disasters of the 20th century. A great Christian nation, Russia, was overthrown and subverted. And it was from a very small percentage of people. Vladimir Lenin and his Bolsheviks didn't represent that many people. They never were more than about 2% of the total population of the country. And yet the Bolsheviks managed to seize control of the largest country on earth, the greatest Christian empire at the time in terms of numbers and land space. And they murdered the royal family. So the Tsar's family, the Romanovs, the Tsar, his beautiful wife, his four lovely daughters, his son, all murdered, along with their servants who were with them, on the 17th of July, 1918. So this coming week will be the 100th anniversary of the murder of the Tsar's family. And it's a terrible, terrible thing, because it marked the end of Christian servant leaders, and it marked the rise of the commissars. You know, sure. One Tsar replaced by hundreds of thousands of commissars. Sure. The Tsar was a person who gave power to the parliament, who was moving in a democratic direction, even though, of course, the media repeats the lie that he was not. But here's just a fact that will shock most people, because the average person has heard, well, Vladimir Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution overthrew the Tsar of Russia. That's not true. The Tsar of Russia abdicated voluntarily under pressure from his parliament, the Duma. The Bolsheviks overthrew the Duma, the parliament of Russia. And so that doesn't make as good a story. It's far nicer to say there was no freedom in Russia. And so in order to give freedom, because there was just one man who had all power, the Bolshevik Revolution rose up to take away power and to give the power to the people. Not so. They overthrew the parliament. The parliament represented the people of Russia, and they don't want to admit that. And who opened the Duma and gave the Duma that power? Well, this totalitarian dictator, the Tsar, who's not meant to believe in democracy. But why then did he give power to the parliament, and why did he voluntarily abdicate? So you've got a totally different story out there versus the reality. So, for example, the Black Book of Communism, written by ex-communists, has documented that under the Tsar, there were about 69 executions a year. Now, that would be people killed for everything from murder, kidnapping, assassinations, whatever there was out there, rape and so on. So in the whole of the great vast Russian Empire across nine time zones, they were executed about 67 to 69 people a year.
Sure.
Under Vladimir Lenin, it went to the hundreds of thousands and then the millions a year. And whereas the Tsar had a secret police force of a couple of hundred, the commissars had a secret police, the KGB, of 3 million. 3 million. Now, and they want to tell you that the Tsar was oppressive, because, you know, 69 people were executed a year, but the commissars were liberators because they were, yes, exactly, you know, murderers being executed,
yeah,
versus hundreds of thousands of Christians, including 150,000 ministers of the gospel, executed just in one concentration camp. the first one, that's Solovetsky Island, 95,000 ministers of the gospel were executed by firing squads or a single bullet in the head normally in the first 5 years of the Bolshevik Revolution. So for people to try and depict the Tsar as oppressive and the commissars or Lenin and the Bolsheviks as liberators, it's so far from the truth. It's not just laughable, it's disgraceful. And the only people who can propagate those kind of lies are people who've been deceived themselves and know nothing, or devious, dishonest disinformants of the revolution. So yes, the communist revolutions have proved to be the greatest killer in history. In the 20th century, according to Professor Rummel of Hawaii University, who's written a book, Death by Government, he's documented that the communist governments, the secular humanist governments of the 20th century, killed over 268 million people, most of which are not killed in war, most of which are not foreigners killed by invading armies. Most of those were citizens, civilians, killed by their own governments. Communist governments, socialist governments, humanist governments, in the name of the state, in the name of liberty, equality, and fraternity. So the French Revolution was bad. The Bolshevik Revolution was even worse.
Sure, yeah. And as the Black Book also documents, that communist states aren't merely or don't merely commit criminal acts, but they're actually criminal enterprises in their very essence. And in principle, they are ruled by lawlessness, by violence, and without any regard of human life. So instead of this workers' paradise that they promised, they end up with hell on earth instead of heaven on earth.
Yes, Psalm 14 verse 1 says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there's no one who does good." And we also read in the Bible that there are those who promise them freedom, but they are slaves of depravity, slaves of corruption. 2 Peter 2:19 could be written over all these revolutions. Mm. While they promise them freedom, they themselves are slaves of corruption.
Yeah, that's so tragic. And another thing with this is that because their life gets devalued, it gets them off the hook for being lazy, for being immoral, and all that kind of thing. And so, as Jean-Paul Sartre explained, that without God, all activities are equivalent. So it amounts to the same thing, whether one gets drunk alone or is the leader of a nation. And so the drunken man doesn't need to strive for anything greater, as at the end of the day, it's the same. So that's really tragic. Do you think that the leaders actually that promote this lifestyle, this relativism or humanism, do you think they themselves believe it? Or do you think they simply use it as a way to control the pawns at the bottom, keeping them ignorant and distracted?
Yes. I think that they may have started out as new recruits believing the propaganda and this is for a new and better world for all. But by the time they've got to be major leaders in the upper echelon of the communist parties, they no longer believe in communism. They just see it as a convenient way to power and to confuse people. It's just like a con man. He doesn't believe the lies he tells people in order to separate them from their watch or their money or whatever it is they're trying to steal them from. But I think the same thing with these corrupt politicians. They've discovered communism is the ideal lie in order to mesmerize people from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. Land, jobs, homes, peace, whatever the people want, they promise. And many people get mesmerized. But I think the con men and the dictators at the top, they know. I mean, there's nowhere that Robert Mugabe living in his opulent palace, stealing billions and billions of dollars from the people and impoverishing them while they starved, really thought he was helping the people and serving them. He just thought, you know, I'm getting my just desserts and I'm getting rewarded. And I think he's probably laughing at these fools who believed his speeches and cheered and applauded him while he was starving and oppressing them. I don't think the top leaders at all believe in the rhetoric, but they might have in the early days when they were being recruited. And you can see it when you start to look at the heart and soul of Karl Marx. And we've got a study on that, on how Karl Marx was actually an occultic Satanist, an antichrist, who literally, you've just got to see from his own writings, how he wanted to destroy God's creation. He wanted to bring down Christ. He hated Christ and even said that he knew that a soul, once true to God, is now destined for hell. And he reveled in the fact that he is an enemy of God. And many of them do. And the Soviet Union literally had slogans like, "We will drive the capitalists from the earth and God from heaven." And we wage war to snatch believers from God. And that's why they destroyed those 49,000 churches, either confiscated or destroyed, including dynamiting the largest church in Russia, in Moscow, Christ the Savior Cathedral, third largest church in the world at that time, destroying it. And then they wanted to build on it a pyramid-like Tower of Babel with a statue and idol of Lenin on top, shaking his fist in God's face. Now, that was never completed. And today, the Christian Russians have rebuilt Christ Savior Cathedral over that spot where that old church had stood. And so you can see the symbolism of the victory of Christ over communism. But we need to understand this is where revolutionaries go. And we need to read books like Robespierre, Inside the French Revolution by Otto Scott, or The Black Book of Communism. It's a hard read, but we've done summaries of it. Death by Government by Professor Rummel. Again, it's a hard read. It's a lot of statistics and facts, but the documentation is colossal. Again, we've done summaries of it. So a person can come onto our website, onto the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism Facebook page, or the HMS School of Christian Journalism website, and on the frontlinemissionsa.org website, and see a lot of articles on communism, on revolution, on the French Revolution. This Thursday we're going to be dealing with the French Revolution at the Reformation Society, and we'll produce, God willing, an audio and a video of the French Revolution, which will then be uploaded on the websites, and you can view it on our Vimeo page, share it, show it to others, and hopefully instruct your people. We've got the PowerPoint in the French Revolution, and we need to have our people understanding revolution and seeing there's nothing to celebrate on the 14th of July. It's something to learn from, but the French Revolution was not something that freedom-loving people can rejoice in. It's something we should learn from and avoid.
For sure. So we can see that these revolutions and things that go down in history do impact us today, and we need to learn from them. And so we need to also spread this truth with all of those around us.
We do indeed. And the whole thing, as we head into these different anniversaries, let's remind people that the beautiful family of the Tsar's family, the Romanovs, were murdered on the 17th of July, 100 years ago this year, on the 17th of July in 1918 by the Bolsheviks. We should remember them, and we should ensure that such people did not die in vain. And that we warn people about where anti-God, secular humanist, revolutionary utopian ideas lead. People need to understand the consequences. In 1 Corinthians 10, 6 to 11, we read, "Now these things became my examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for admonition."
Fantastic, yeah. Let's learn from this truth, let's spread this truth, and we know that when we know the truth will set us free. Thank you very much, Dr. Hammond. Good evening.